This is side two of tape one of Steve Mouche interview. When the tape ended, we were talking about the logs, the station logs of the early WKAR, and you mentioned that you didn't know exactly where they were, but you had seen them at some point.
I'm sure they're still around somewhere. Unfortunately, we did not do, not necessarily me, but mm-hmm. I think I like collecting things, historical things, and unfortunately there's not a lot. There's a lot of photos and some written stuff, but boy, there aren't a lot of programs. It would be hard to really preserve programs that were, first of all, nothing was recorded early on. Very little was recorded. What was recorded on these giant transcriptions that you would cut something onto a huge platter.
A larger record?
They were 14 or 16 inches, like a big pizza box. Uh-huh. In fact, all of our theme songs for all the different classical music shows and stuff were all on transcriptions, where they'd been cut to a transcription, and you had to have these giant players.
Mm-hmm. And then when you were going from one to another, during the course of the broadcast, you had to, what was the process where you were able to use them?
Two turntables.
Oh, okay.
So you could always have the next one ready over there, mm-hmm. and they were quite clunky, and mm-hmm. They had those styluses in them, and mm-hmm. they would get dirt on them and sound funny. And
mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about after you graduated, how was it that you ended up staying here at the university?
Actually, I was offered a full-time permanent position at WKAR before I graduated.
Oh, really?
In 1965. And as a producer-director. And I have a funny, just an aside to that thing that I will never forget, and that is, remember, I was an out-of-state student because I was from Ohio, so I was paying a lot more than in-state students. Suddenly, I was employed full-time by MSU, and so I went over to the registrar's office or whoever was in charge of that. I remember that in the old administration building, and said, I don't think I should be paying out-of-state tuition anymore. And they said, well, why is that? And I said, well, how can I be out-of-state if I'm a full-time employee of MSU? And they told me that it didn't matter, I should still have to pay it. And I don't remember what I did. I wasn't surly or anything. But eventually, they decided that, no, maybe I only had to pay in-state tuition if I worked for the university full-time.
You weren't commuting from Dayton?
No. But that was only the last one or two terms mm-hmm. before mm-hmm. I graduated.
Mm-hmm. Were you doing music at that time, or was it news production? Or
actually, I was doing both. I was doing the, before I, even while I was still a student, I was doing the sign-on program, the first program at the beginning of the day, which was a music program, interestingly enough, mostly big band music. And then I also was, eventually, I did a whole bunch of programs. At that time, we had programs. You know, today radio stations have formats. You have a favorite format. You don't have a favorite, necessarily, radio program. Mm-hmm. You may have a favorite television program, of course, mm-hmm. but you have favorite radio stations. But we had all these compartmentalized programs. We had the Homemakers Hour and the Farm Service Hour and a program called The Scrapbook, which I did for years after the producer who had done it for years left and went to get a PhD at Stanford or somewhere. Mm-hmm.
What was The Scrapbook about?
The Scrapbook was a great show. It was a variety, a show of news, interesting kind of tidbits, interviews with people, and music. And I actually kind of broke the music barrier on the station, because I would play stuff that had never been played before. And I mean, I played the Beatles.
Oh, really?
Nobody played the Beatles on WKR at the time.
Did you hear from President Hanna about that?
No, actually, it was, I enjoyed doing it. I just felt like if there was something that was interesting, that it would be fun to play it on that program. Mm-hmm. But we had, like I said, we had Farm Service Hour, the women's show, the scrapbook. There was a show called Listen to the Band. Some of these were just 15 minutes long. So we had like a marching band show every afternoon. We had a Broadway show. And my favorite was Hymns You Love. And I would do Listen to the Band or Hymns You Love or these shows. And Hymns You Love, I always thought Hymns You Love was amusing because it was 15 minutes long. And you'd play one religious album for 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. But it was white Anglo-Saxon Protestant hymns you love. Well, I played Mahalia Jackson. So, but those shows eventually all went away, and then the big year was 1965 when we split the two stations. So for the first time, the FM station became totally separate programming than the AM station. Well, I shouldn't say that. Some of the programs were still simulcast, but a radical step for the stations at the time.
Did the FM station concentrate on classical at that time, or
classical? It was very eclectic. Mm-hmm. It was the programmer was Ken Beechler, who was the music director at the time. Ken is an absolutely brilliant person when it comes to the arts and culture. And again, it was a period when we didn't have a lot of audience research. Remember, we still weren't fundraising. Mm-hmm. So it was, there was an MSU professor named Hans Nathan, who was an expert in new classical music, the stuff that drove me nuts, because it wasn't, it was atonal. He used to have a show, so we'd play that. Beechler would weave Dylan Thomas reading poetry in the middle of classical music. And we would play, there's an old joke in public radio today that some of the classical music stations that are classical music stations, if you can't dance to it, don't play it. This is classical music, right? Mm-hmm. Well, believe me, we played a lot of classical music you couldn't dance to.
I'm glad you mentioned Ken Beechler, but was he directly involved in broadcasting?
Yes, he did programming on the air, but he was the architect of the new FM format. Mm-hmm. And I did the sign-on show, the first show of the day at 6:30 in the morning.
For FM?
For the new, newly separated from the AM station FM.
And do you remember what year that was again?
65.
And 65, okay. And was that about the time when more people started getting FM station or FM broadcast? You mentioned that graph or the two,
right? And that I think that was in the late 70s crossover happened. But I think there were enough people listening to FM that it certainly made sense to have two separate program stations. Again, remember, no network.
Yep.
The programs, the external programs we had, and the other thing that's important compared to today with public radio stations is there weren't very many public radio stations. Mm-hmm. The early public radio stations were almost all affiliated with colleges and universities, MSU was one of the very, very first, and they were, hugely popular in the Big Ten. Mm-hmm. Big Ten had, you know, the public, they were kind of the dominant force in early educational, mm-hmm. they weren't called public radio then, educational mm-hmm. radio stations. And so there weren't very many stations, but there was a network, not an interconnection network, run by the National Association of Educational Broadcasters, and they were headquartered in at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. And stations would produce programs that were intended for more than a local audience, a national audience, and then submit them to NAEB to possibly be accepted for national distribution. And then what you do is, in the mail, it all sounds so old-fashioned. In the mail every quarter, you would get a catalog of shows that were available, and then you'd order them, and then they would come in boxes in the mail on tapes.
On tapes, okay.
So it was all bicycling, what we call bicycling tapes around. And it was like, when you're done with your tapes, you send them on to Ohio State.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like what movies used to be, or 60-millimeter yep. movies. Or.
And it was so funny, because at the time, everything, again, and this is this whole notion of programs instead of formats, everything was 13 weeks, a quarter. So it would either be 13 half hours or 13 hours. And you'd play one a week mm-hmm. for 13 weeks at, you know, a given time. Mm-hmm. And those are the kind of programs we were producing here locally. We weren't always producing 13 in a series, but I was producing local series. And then I also got a grant and produced a national series that was distributed nationally by NAEB called The Circumstance of Science, which was about science in the late 60s.
Where, did you do anything at that time on the cyclotron or any of the research that was going on campus?
Was that going on at that time in the late 60s?
But, well, it was just starting, but...
Yeah. I didn't do anything.
Okay.
I was focusing a lot on the programs I was producing, and this would be after you do your show, mm-hmm. the scrapbook or this morning show, then you would spend the rest of your day producing programs. It was very clunky the way programs were produced then. You literally had to cut the tape with razor blades and mm-hmm. splice it with splicing tape.
Today, physical editing.
Interesting, yeah. Today at the radio station, WKAR, there is no tape.
No tape. Amazing.
It's all digital, hard disk, everything. But I was focusing primarily on programs about youth issues. We had another producer who was doing environmental-related stuff. And then I did, with another producer, we did a program about The Poor, was the name of the series, mm-hmm. in the Lansing area, focusing principally on migratory workers in Michigan. At the time, Michigan was the third largest employer of migrant labor, which is hard to believe. Mm-hmm. And they were right here. They were over west of here in Eaton Rapids, mm-hmm. picking pickles.
Mm-hmm.
And of course up north and over on the west coast with all the fruit farms.
Mm-hmm.
And the conditions were pretty intolerable for the living conditions and the social services. And we hitched up with some people who were working for the state trying to improve the conditions and spent a lot of time at migrant labor camps doing this series.
Mm-hmm.
It was quite enlightening because I led a rather sheltered life growing up in Ohio, and
to see the migrant
this whole experience, I think that was what the college experience did.
How'd you approach it for radio? I mean, one can understand and one has seen documentaries with film and videotape, but how would you approach that those same topics with radio?
It was a lot of interview stuff. The way programs were produced at the time, it would be, and I have the poor tapes, it would be, but I haven't listened to them, it would sound so rudimentary if you listened to the way those shows, I think, were produced. Mm-hmm. A lot of just interview, and, you know, today the stuff, the radio material has so much sound and things. I mean, we were riding around on these dusty country roads with this man named Ubaldo Patino, who I believe is still alive. We did a documentary about the Hispanic migration to the Lansing area a few years ago on TV, and he was one of the interviewees. And we probably weren't recording talking to him while the car was bouncing over the road and the dust was blowing in the window. And you know, if you did mm-hmm. something today, that's the way you'd record the interview mm-hmm. with him.
Right.
We probably said, stop, turn off the car so we can do this interview. You know.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And so that one got picked up by the NAEB?
Not the pork, because that was local.
Okay.
The Circumstance of Science one.
Okay.
Did.
Okay. Were you working on a master's or anything at that
yes.
time? Okay. You
yes.
were right on campus.
Uh-huh. Right. Uh-huh. I got a master's in, I don't know if it was still called television, radio, and film at the time or not.
Mm-hmm.
My thesis advisor was, there were some really good professors in the television, radio, and film department, was Arthur Weld, who was like within 5 minutes of a PhD in French and never got his PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And he taught film courses.
Hmm.
And my master's thesis, which interestingly enough, my granddaughter, my 16-year-old granddaughter, who is a movie nut and very interested in drama, ended up, saw my thesis at my house and read it a month or so ago, and she said, can I read this? And I said, it's very academic. This is not fun stuff. And she said, no, I'd like to read it. So she mm-hmm. took it home and she brought it back and she said, I thought that was very interesting. She said, you write just like I do. But anyway,
you must have felt very good about that.
it was about violence in motion pictures.
Okay.
And the movie Bonnie and Clyde,
okay.
at the time, was a watershed movie because it was considered by many critics to be one of the most violent movies ever made.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a lot of fun doing that thesis because there were incredibly good film critics during those times. And I did this research project about the evolution of violence in motion pictures and how Bonnie and Clyde became a watershed in terms of how movies were made. It pales by comparison, of course, to today,
mm-hmm.
but it was a fun thesis, and Art Weld was my advisor for that, and he retired and moved to Florida, and I think someone told me recently that he has passed away. I'm mm-hmm. not sure.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to use any of your master's work in your later broadcasting at all, or
a master's degree? I never had a job that required a master's degree. Mm-hmm. Well, I shouldn't say that. I did teach at MSU for a couple of years, shortly after I got my master's.
Mm-hmm.
And I also taught a broadcasting course at Lansing Community College for a while, too. The MSU, I was teaching radio production. And it's funny because I happen to still have my grade sheet. Because the final exam had to be a student, each student had to do a radio production mm-hmm. on tape. And I thought I had that, some of those tapes, but I'm not quite sure, and the notes I wrote. But I had two notable students when I taught at MSU. One is my dear friend who just retired from WKAR, Hal Prentice, who was the music director at WKAR for years and years. And at his retirement, I embarrassed him because I had the grade sheet and Hal got a B minus, even though there were a lot of A's. But the other person who was in the class was Steve Garvey, famous baseball player. Uh-huh. Steve didn't work too hard in that class. I think maybe he was too focused on baseball at the time.
It sounded like he had a, as I recall, he had a good radio voice.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting.
And that, and those facilities were so funny compared to today. They were up above Fairchild Theater.
Okay.
A couple of rooms up there.
Just across the street from where we are.
Yeah, the other end of the auditorium building. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And I can see that equipment now. Mm-hmm. It was so, today it would just look like it belonged in a museum. Well, it belonged in a museum. It was funny, the Michigan Association of Broadcasters had a display of history of broadcasting a few years ago at the Michigan Historical Museum, the State Historical Museum. Mm-hmm. And we had a reception down there for our donors and stuff. And it was like deja vu. Part of the display was a radio control room, and it was the same equipment that we had at WKAR when I started there. It was mm-hmm. like, oh my goodness, I cannot believe this. Where did they get this?
Yeah. Did you find out where they got it?
No. But right next to that, of course, was a digital TV set, too. Uh-huh.
Were you, as in terms of the tremendous technological change that you have seen in the course of your career, which you've mentioned a little bit, how was it hard or easy to keep track of all those changes, or did you anticipate those as a radio man? Did you anticipate those as with?
I wouldn't say it was hard, but boy, there was a lot of oh wow to it. Okay. I mean, there were so many moments. And some of them today don't sound like they're very dramatic at all. I mean, I remember, you know, when we first became connected to National Public Radio.
Okay.
And it was on telephone lines, not satellite. The satellite didn't come till 5 or 6 years later. Mm-hmm. So everything we got from NPR came over these not very high quality phone lines, and it was like, oh wow, I'm listening to a real public radio network coming from Washington. Mm-hmm. And I remember sitting there and listening to it, and the first thing they ever fed to stations, the very first thing, it was when the Vietnam veterans protested at the Supreme Court in Washington. And it was a piece that a man named Jim Russell, who's still working in public broadcasting today, did of the Vietnam veterans protesters at the Supreme Court. And I'm sitting here listening to this thing, and it was sound of them arresting the veterans, putting them in a bus and driving away as they chanted, 1, 2, 3, 4, we don't want your fucking war. And I went, oh, wait a minute. Can we broadcast this? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We've never had to deal with anything like this before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting. And that was broadcast on WKR?
I don't remember.
John Kerry was involved with the Vietnam veterans.
Yep.
Against the war, VVAW, I know. How was it was MSU, did they sign on to NPR relatively early?
We were one of the very first stations. And I think today there are at least 800 mm-hmm. NPR stations. There were less than 100 in the beginning. I think it might have been around 70. Mm-hmm. It was absolutely fascinating because it was just such a breakthrough moment for us, because it just totally liberated us from being confined in a kind of smaller world.
Mm-hmm. Did you find that there was the audience was interested in that at the time, or were they doing any surveys at?
That was just starting.
Okay.
It was just starting, and as I recall, our FM audience at the time, our weekly FM audience was around 15,000 to 20,000 people. Today it's over 100,000 every week at least. So much of that is due to NPR. So much of it is due to commercial radio too. Thank you very much. I mean, commercial radio has been very successful, I think, in driving people to discover and find a place where you don't have to listen to endless commercials and disc jockeys that talk nonsense all morning long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's the audience for National Public Radio is just huge now for public radio stations.
Mm-hmm. When in the late 60s, who was head of broadcasting at MSU at that time?
Interestingly enough, MSU was one of the few places, especially in the Big Ten, that with both television and radio stations that were separately administered.
Okay.
So there was no... Well, actually, there was a man named Armand Hunter, who was the founder of television at MSU, who convinced John Hanna that that the university should become involved in TV at such an early time for TV, 1954.
Oh, sure.
And he was around for a while. I had the real honor and privilege of knowing him, because he's truly the MSU at least television pioneer. Mm-hmm. But in 1960s, late 60s, Dick Estelle was the manager of the radio station.
Okay.
I became the manager of the radio station in 1978. I was the program manager beginning in 1969. Okay. So from 69 to 78, I was in charge of all the programming, and all of the producers worked for me.
Mm-hmm. Did, as you linked with NPR, was there less local programming that was produced?
No, not at that time, because at that time we still were 100% paid for. Well, maybe things were getting tight then, because we didn't have our first fundraiser until 1975. And NPR started in 1970, so for that period from 70 to 75, we were still dependent on MSU for 100% of our support. Mm-hmm. But I think because we no longer had to deal with the clunky notion of the bicycle tapes, and those of us who and weren't as compartmentalized with the programming, with all of this Homemakers Hour and all this stuff. In fact, at that point in time, at some point along there, we started moving to large blocks of classical music time, especially at night, where the announcers were not really there. They were recorded on tape. So a bit of time was spent every day having to record your announce tape. Mm-hmm. And then a student normally would play the announcer tape, and then the record, and then the announcer tape, and that kind of thing. So I think there was a change in what people had to do that might have freed up people to be able to focus on producing more programming. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot more emphasis then, instead of on that long, there was no more of that, very little of that long form stuff. So we were able to do things like a whole series of programs with the Voice Library at the library, mm-hmm. with Bob Vincent, who of course was the founder when he was still here, and then later we did stuff with Maury Crane. So we did a little national series on that, and we focused a lot. That was when we really got into capital coverage, state government coverage too, because we suddenly realized, see, commercial stations just stopped doing news eventually, so there was a real niche there.
And the proximity of the capital just down the road.
It was a natural, yeah.
Was there any competition between the stations at University of Michigan? Or were you? Did you carve out different? Or did you?
Well, early on, I had incredible respect and admiration for them. For some reason, I felt that they were a better public radio station. I don't know why I would have felt that way, but I admired them a lot, and I admired the man who was leading the station. His name was Ed Burroughs at the time. But then they got in a trap where they didn't change over time, and they maintained that very kind of eclectic, old-fashioned classical music format with announcers who sounded like stuffy old announcers, and they, you know, it's kind of what we call in radio now that you have to sound accessible instead of distant, and so they got stuck in that kind of format until just recently when they completely changed, much to the chagrin of the hardcore classical music lovers down there, and actually totally changed the station to an all-news and talk format. And so there was a long period of time when we became the dominant station, and